Well, good day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is George Christensen, who served for several terms as an Australian federal MP for the seat of Dawson in North Queensland. George has long been an outspoken champion for a variety of conservative causes in Australia. He currently serves as campaign director in Australia for a global organisation called Citizen Go. He's a former journalist, and in my experience, is one of the most well-read politicians I have met, which those who do not know him well are often surprised to hear. My interview with George was prompted by the recent passage of additional hate speech laws by the federal government in Australia, which is just the latest in a series of increasing restrictions on free speech that now exist in this country. In this episode, we discuss what the new hate speech laws mean and why people should be concerned, what is driving the push for these laws, what legislators often don't understand about the effect of such laws, what concerned citizens should do about them going forward, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome, George Christensen, to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be on your podcast. I've been enjoying the work you've been doing with it.
Thanks very much, mate. Good to see you again. Now, you've been an outspoken critic of these new hate speech laws passed by the federal government in Australia last week. For the layperson who's only been vaguely tuning in, what's the best way to understand the changes that were legislated?
Well, look, I'm against anything that's going to clamp down on freedom of speech, but this is a most egregious piece of legislation that's now actually law, or it's on its way to be law. What it's done, it's changed, it's actually turned the normal process of law on its head. So instead of actually having an intent to commit violence, all there needs to be is the possibility that there might be violence, and the notion that you have been reckless in what you have said. Now, that's an extremely subjective term. It is very much unclear as to what that actually means. I put forward a number of examples, and the fact is, I don't think anyone can actually say that these examples would be allowed under the law, or they would not be allowed, because it is such a grey area. But for instance, if I was raging against the whole gender fluidity nonsense that's being taught in schools these days, and I said something akin to, you know, the LGBTIQ crowd are indoctrinating our children, and it's high time we push back on that. We've got to take action. And if someone then interpreted that as the pushing back and the taking action was an incitement to violence, I think they could run that that flag up the pole, actually. And, it's like with all these sorts of things, the process becomes the punishment, and therefore there's a chilling effect on free speech, and people just don't go to those areas. And I think that's partly the intent of this law, actually.
Yeah. So you're associated with an organisation called Citizen Go, conservative global organisation pushing for a variety of, good things, from what I've been able to ascertain. Your post on these new laws on X was shared by Citizen Go, and their comments underneath it were then deleted. Do you have any information about why that occurred?
Well, actually, just to clarify, Brian Marlowe, who is a campaigner for Citizen Go, posted those comments there. They weren't my comments. They were his through the Citizen Go account. And it was going, semi-viral. It had a reach of over 50,000 within a very short period of time. And then next thing, the majority of the thread is just taken offline, and actually he's locked out of his Twitter account, or his X account. Now, there's only two possibilities. One, you can be forgiven if we're wrong on this because there's form, but the eSafety Commissioner generates complaints, which they've just got in trouble to recently, what they call informal takedown orders, and whether or not they're still generating those informal takedown orders and sending them off to X, we just simply don't know. The other thing is that I think that Elon Musk needs to have a relook at recent changes that he's brought into 2X, and that is if a number of verified people on his platform complain about something and say that it's hate speech or inciting violence or whatever it might be, it can be taken down pending a review. And what ended up happening is that we quickly went through the review and it was restored. So, we're not sure whether this was one of those informal takedown orders or whether it was just a targeted campaign by leftists just against our post, which was going like wildfire at the time, actually.
Yeah, and that would have had the effect in potentially slowing down its reach, right? Because then, it inhibits the ability of people to see what you're on about, and then by the time they get around to it, it doesn't quite have the
That's
punch
correct.
It did in the release. Yeah,
so it's the most bizarre situation where we're complaining about the very thing that actually happened to us. It's almost proves our point. But yes, look, actually, in this instance, I think that whoever did it, whoever was behind this this takedown, that it backfired because people started actually pointing out that the post had come down offline, and then that started going like wildfire. So, the people who want to censor us are invariably from the left, Dan. I can't think of many from the right that want to censor other people for leftist views that they might say. Now, apart from in the mainstream Liberal Party, and if I can quickly segue to that, that has been the most disappointing thing of all, that the erstwhile Conservative Party actually backed these laws. And I think that they've done it with good intent. Of course, there's a bunch of radical Islamists that are running around the streets of Sydney and Victoria, and they're causing all sorts of chaos. We've imported a very big Middle Eastern problem in this country, and we see it playing out on the streets. And quite frankly, it's not our problem, should never have been our problem, should never have been allowed to be our problem. And that's big immigration that's at fault there. But nonetheless, I think that what the Liberal Party is doing is saying we need to find a way to deal with these people who are running around and saying death to the Jews and the like, and a way that can deal with them pretty quick, smart, and sort of case closed. And this is why they pushed the mandatory sentencing. But the problem is that I foresee, and many others do foresee, these laws being used by a range of different other victim groups that the actual legislation creates. So it's not just limited to Jews, although that's how it's been marketed. We're talking about gender identity, sexual orientation, even religious status, which is the Jewish thing. But if this law was enacted and I started talking about radical Muslims over and over again and saying that they should be all deported, that could be considered a violent statement or a statement that incites violence, and that could be used against me. So it's bizarre that the thing that they're trying to nip in the bud here could be something that's actually used by that uses the legislation to get what they want.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there's a lot of well-meaning legislatures that are under pressure to try and do something about this spate of alleged terrorist attacks. I mean, all those things are yet to be formally confirmed, but you can kind of understand that they're calling on the government to do something, and they want to do something, right? So what do you think ultimately will happen with the enforcement of these laws? For example, Lydia Thorpe recently at a Australia Day march screamed, "This is war," brandished a battle stick and yelled about black women being raped by them at the Invasion Day protests. I mean, is there any likelihood she I think she's a dill, I actually don't think she should be prosecuted for those statements. But do you think there's really any likelihood that the authorities will take action against her for making those, the statements
if you're from if you're coming at it from a leftist perspective, I don't think that you have anything to worry about, quite frankly. I think that this will be very subjective. We know what the federal public service is like. You know, Mark Dreyfus is one of the more left-wing people in the Albanese government, and you know, he's no doubt moulded his department in the fashion that he likes. And so, you know, when something comes up, I don't expect that any leftist will be raked over the knuckles or raked over the coals. That, you know, it just won't happen. What they will do is they will target conservatives. And if you think that that's not possible, just look at the UK. You know, you talked about Citizen Go before. One of my colleagues there in the UK is a woman by the name of Carolyn Farrow. Carolyn actually is a mother of three, I think, and she's in that quirky situation where she finds herself a Roman Catholic priest's wife because he converted from the Church of England to Roman Catholicism and was accepted in, as a priest. So here we've got a vicar's wife, you know, mother of three, I think it is. She's at home on a Saturday night or whatever, cooking a chicken dinner. And there's a knock on the door by the police who subsequently raid her house because of a complaint about a mean tweet, you know, and she didn't actually even put the tweet up. It was just alleged that she had some secret account where she was running this stuff. So they tried to get every device from the house. They put her in handcuffs, let her outside, put her in the car, took her back to the station. And that's not an isolated incident. We see veterans that complain about issues to do with immigration that are arrested and, you know, charged with hate crime offences, hate speech offences. We've seen an autistic girl who was manhandled by a female police officer, ripped from underneath the stairs where she was hiding. And why? Because this girl who had, you know, a severe level of autism had actually said that she looked like a lesbian nana. Now, you know, to think that calling someone a lesbian nana, and particularly someone who has autism, would lead that person to being thrown in the back of a, it was a minor, by the way, not an adult, but still being thrown in the back of a police wagon, taken to the police station and formally charged and all the rest of it. So this is the future for Australia. And the more and more we have hate speech laws at either federal or state level, we are going to find that will be our future. And, you know, the good news is, I guess, in the UK now, people are completely and utterly fed up with the status quo. They elected a conservative government that did anything but conservative stuff. They just doubled down on all of the leftist nonsense. Now they've got a Labor government simply because they threw out one side and they got the other side. And, you know, they are on the nose big time. And now Reform, Nigel Farage's party, is ahead in the polls of both of the other two parties. That's a turn up for the books. But that actually is what happens when this sort of stuff goes too far. And so I just say, have a look at that trajectory. We've also seen that, I guess, to some extent in the United States, although they don't have the big clampdown on free speech because of their constitutional amendments. But nonetheless, the Biden administration was, you know, up to its eyeballs and machinations to get stuff taken down off Twitter. Also playing in that field was the FBI and other three-letter name agencies. So, you know, and the swingbacks happened with Donald Trump. So the good news is we will go through the storm, but at the end of that storm will be the sunshine, and at least for conservatives, where all of this stuff will be dismantled. I'll have no doubt that this will play out in Australia. Again, I actually don't think there's any stopping it right now because, sadly, we've got the Liberal Party and the Labor Party on a unity ticket at the moment on a lot of these matters, whether it be this hate speech law, the age verification stuff. Though they voted against it, they still are supportive of some type of digital identity scheme, all of this sort of stuff, the two major parties are in lockstep with each other. So there will be a pushback eventually, Dan.
You spent many years in federal parliament and got contacts and friends still in there, I believe. What's the best explanation that they've provided to you, to those you've been in touch with, about why this isn't as big a deal as you think, George?
Well, look, I won't name names, but one person did suggest to me that it had specifically to be violence that was being urged, and that's why they voted the way that they voted. However, we'll name one person. Senator Matt Canavan actually pointed out that that was not really the case, because he moved an amendment to this bill that actually sought to define the terms violence as physical violence and force as physical force within the bill. The Senate rejected that amendment, and that speaks volumes. So we're not actually talking about physical violence here and incitement to physical violence. And by the way, I do maintain that given that you've stripped intent out of the entire thing, it just becomes completely subjective to work out whether something is an incitement to violence and whether it is reckless or not, because in the normal rhetoric that we use in political life, you know, you're going to stand up to them, we're going to go into battle, all that sort of rhetoric could be seen as violence or an incitement to violence, even if there's no intent, because intent has been stripped out of the legislation.
Yeah, I think it's important to stress too that these are federal criminal penalties that apply with, as you say, new, vague, unknown standards for the application of law with mandatory sentences. So unlike some of the stuff that we've battled with over the years, 18C under the Federal Discrimination Act, people have been taken to court and lost, like Andrew Bolt, and then Pauline Hanson most recently got also lost for telling a senator she needed to go back to Pakistan and the like. These involve criminal penalties. Yeah. One thing Australians sort of assume we have freedom of speech, and Americans sort of assume Australians have more or less the same thing that they do too. But, you know, it is the case, is it not, George, in your view, that if Elon Musk made that sort of what seemed a bit like a Nazi salute but wasn't really at one of his one of the rallies post the election of Donald Trump, he would stand a real risk of potentially being prosecuted in Australia for making a Nazi salute?
Most certainly he would. And, again, with the intent stripped out of it, who knows whether they would say that doing that particular salute was an incitement to violence, given, the history of the Nazi salute, which it was not. I'm going to say, though, that I'm going to get myself into hot water saying this. You know what? If you truly believe in free speech, you wouldn't outlaw the Nazi salute. If you truly believed in free speech, you wouldn't be outlawing swastikas.
I agree, man.
You know, if you know some idiot wants to go and put up a swastika outside their shop front, they're going to find pretty quickly that they have no customers. Or they're going to find that no one turns up to their local barbecue if it's put up outside their house. I think that in a society that bases itself around freedom and free speech, that these things get ironed out by public opinion, quite frankly. But where it's where we're restricted from saying stuff, doing stuff, do you really think that a law saying that someone who wants to do an actual Nazi salute, who wants to put up an actual Nazi flag, is going to stop them from being a Nazi? Do you really think that it's going to do that? Or do you think that it's going to drive them underground, perhaps to get more and more radicalized until they do something that actually is really stupid and does cause violence? I think that that's the bigger danger here.
Yeah. It's almost that, though, we actually... grant too much power to these silly little symbols or these names, right? Like the Nazi Party, National Socialist Workers Party in Germany, no longer exists. It's an old, antiquated, no doubt people who suffered, Jews and others who suffered under that regime, feel very strongly about that symbol and it causes emotional distress. I get it. And no doubt it can be used provocatively for people who want to intimidate people. But in and of itself, it's just a silly little symbol. And so prosecute people, as was already the case under common law and in other pieces of legislation, for genuine, genuine incitements to violence or threats of violence. You achieve nothing by lower the standard or granting these things as though they're some sort of evil amulet that you can't have to cover with a sort of a cloth because they have the power. They're not as important as that, I would have thought, right?
And we're a bit schizophrenic about it all because you can go and wear a communist flag symbol on your shirt, you know, the hammer and sickle. How many people died under Soviet communism? How many Jews died under Soviet communism? So, you know, it's very, very strange where we've just sort of isolated this one group. And I think you're right. We've in isolating that one group, we've given them far too much credence, far too much weight, which is, you know, I reckon, look, I was going to say something which is not true, but it wouldn't be, it is a bit of an exaggeration, but in the grand scheme of things, it's probably right. You could count the number of neo-Nazis in Australia, metaphorically speaking, on your hands and toes. You know, there ain't too many people who would line up at the ballot box and put a vote down for the National Socialist Workers Party of Australia. You know, it just isn't going to happen. So they're not, you know, when they go out and deface places of worship, throw the book at them. That's actually vandalism. When they go out and they actually incite violence, like really incite it by saying something that everyone would consider violent, such as death to the insert whatever racial group you want here, that is an incitement to violence. So, you know,
even more true than that, go and burn that place down. You know, that's been the standard. Like, it's like, not simply these broad brush political sort of slogans, which people can make in the, I don't know, abstract and not really mean. There's a lot of, I find with these national socialists, because people, they've become the big boogeyman, even though, like you say, there's probably only a handful that exist in the world and they're not even a registered political party anywhere, right? That it actually encourages people to sort of cosplay and pretend they're these, like, you know, badasses doing badass things when if they were just ridiculed and exposed to sort of full and frank debate, or at least, you know, I mean, like, they're if they've got any particular grievances, which separate from the kind of, you know, ideology of the 1940s or whatever it was, they can be aired separately, right? They can be discussed separately. You just don't have to sort of like taint the whole thing with this brush to discredit any discussion about anything. I guess one other thing I was trying to for an American audience or anyone's tuning in is that people don't really understand that in Australia, and this is not the case with these new laws, but if in Australia came up and said his famous line, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best, they're sending people with lots of problems, they're bringing those problems with us, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're bringing rapists. He said that in Australia, which launched his presidential campaign in the US. If he said that in Australia, he would stand a real risk, I think, of an 18C prosecution,
yep, right?
Or some other
state-based complaint system. But yeah, you're right. The Racial Discrimination Act is an inhibitor on free speech in this country, and we saw that with Andrew Bolt. You mentioned before. I mean, when Andrew Bolt got taken through that whole system and found guilty. You need to understand what Andrew was actually writing about, which was what was complained about. And it goes to the heart of the whole thing. He's saying that people are now falsely claiming to be Aboriginal Australians. so that they can take on all of these benefits that are offered, all of these protections in law, such as the Racial Discrimination Act, that are now offered. And, you know, for that, he was taken through that racial discrimination process and found guilty. Now, when you can't actually challenge the basis of a system going forward, you have completely and utterly stifled political communication in this country. And I would maintain that I just can't recall whether that went to the High Court. I really can't recall whether it did or not.
That case did, but, it did not. I remember it well, yeah.
It probably bloody well should have, because there is an implied right to political communication, but knowing some judges, there would have been, you know, they would have been having a bit each way even on that. But the reality is, if we've got a Westminster system of government which relies on the open and free exchange of ideas, particularly around policy and law, then that's something that Australians should, quite frankly, have the right to actually be discussing. But we don't have that right because the Racial Discrimination Act and all other state-based acts stops us. It doesn't just go to race. It also goes to a bunch of other, as I said, designated victim classes. For instance, the Archbishop of Hobart at the time, Julian Porteous, very famous case where he had a complaint put against him because he told Catholic school students about the Catholic Church's teaching on marriage, and that is it's between a man and a woman. And for that, he was had a complaint lobbed in to the State-Based Discrimination Commission, and the commissioner actually said that there was a case to answer. Now, when the heat got turned on and this made the headlines and it just looked, you know, completely ridiculous, the complainant actually dropped the complaint against the Archbishop. But nonetheless, as I said, the Discrimination Commissioner said that she wished that they wouldn't have dropped it because there was a case to answer. What kind of society are we living in? It's certainly not a free speech society, where a Catholic archbishop can't tell Catholic school students, or at least their parents via a newsletter that was sent to Catholic school students about the Catholic teaching on marriage. Quite bizarre, but that's the society that we live in.
So much of this, I think, when these legislatures, well-meaning though they are, wanting to do something though they are, they don't quite understand whenever they make changes to the law, they introduce new ambiguities. And in free speech, all that stuff opens up new avenues for people to take action against those who are speaking out on issues. And what, I mean, this is just something to highlight, which others maybe haven't considered, but if you make a comment, say, for example, on immigration on a Twitter, and your comment is not inciting violence, but is spicy, let's say, and someone else below makes a more egregious comment, and an anonymous-based account, which does sort of, you know, go over the top, it's unclear to me, reading through the legislation, whether you would be held, the person who made the original post will be held liable, because that could be potentially be reckless. Recklessly urging action to be taken place. I mean, defamation law, until some of the recent amendments in some states, you could be held liable as an administrator comments made underneath your page. So, again, this is all just to be tested in law. I know the legislature, that wasn't their intention. They think they're like doing stuff to protect Jews or whatever, but they just don't appreciate how the law operates in practice.
I think you're being probably far too kind. I think some of them do realise how the law operates. I think those on the left that are motivated by an agenda of censorship, they don't want these things being talked about, because they know that if you discuss immigration openly and brazenly, if you discuss gender fluidity openly and brazenly, if you discuss a range of different issues which are considered to be politically correct sacred cows, invariably the public at large are going to be on the side of the person doing the critiquing of that. And they want to stop that. They want to remove the ability to have conversations about those, what they would call dangerous areas, so that, there is never any challenge to the system. And I think that is certainly the motivations behind a lot of the leftist governments these days. They know exactly what they're doing, even if they do come at it from, oh, well, this is, you know, stopping these naughty Muslims from saying bad things about Jews. Mm. The reality is they've stuck in the back door a whole heap of other victim classes, which has got nothing to do with that issue whatsoever. They even changed in this bill, this hate crimes bill. They broadened the symbols that you can actually be punished for. Now, previously it was the Nazi flag. Now it's anything that might cause an offence, as I understand it, to people in some of these specific victim classes. So what could that be? You know, Pepe the Frog, is that going to be an image that can't be used? I mean, what is it? I don't understand. It's very subjective once again. At the end of the day, it's a complete and utter inhibitor on free speech.
It was brought in ostensibly in a response to attacks on Jewish places of worship and childcare centres and the like. But they've added, all these classes, intersex, gender status and the rest of it. And all this stuff is untested. Like, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but if someone came out and said that we need to take action to stop children being cut up, mutilated and drugged up in the name of mm-hmm. gender fluidity, that's a provocative statement. Mm-hmm. And that's right. And then so, like, is that allowed? I mean,
I think you've asked a question which no one can answer until it's tested in the courts. You know, for instance, I mean, the law doesn't need for there to be a violent action, but if someone actually got up and said that at a major rally, and then the next day someone punched a drag queen who was doing drag queen story time or whatever, who was at that rally, there may be...
You're not condoned, just to be clear.
No, absolutely. But I'm just saying, like even the speaker wouldn't have condoned that. They had no intent for telling people to go and do that. But someone that might be a little bit unhinged may go and do something, and then there can be a case that's laid out, well, they were reckless because they said it, and this person did something that was violent. Ipso facto, they should be locked up, mandatory sentencing. That's the danger here. It's just such a grey area. It doesn't even require the physical violence to actually occur to lock someone up. I'm just saying in that instance, they might even have a stronger claim to lock you up.
Yeah. Yeah. One other element which I don't think I've seen fully discussed is there are statements in hadiths in the Islamic tradition which explicitly call for violence against Jews. Yes. Now, people have different interpretations of that, but a plain reading would suggest that that's what's suggested. Yes. There are sections, you know, St. Paul's to the Romans, which says some very direct things about same-sex attracted people. Let's put it that way. Is a preacher or an imam or a priest allowed to make those statements in public now? Is he allowed to read? He or she allowed to? Well, generally, he allowed to read those to a congregation? I don't know.
My guess would be no. And again, I'm guessing it's very subjective, but they have completely and utterly removed the religious and political speech protections that were previously there. So you could say, well, I'm exercising my right to talk about religious matters, particularly as a pastor to their flock or as an imam to his mosque. But now that has been taken away. And, of course, the Liberal Party are right behind this because we see in the media all the time some crazy imam that's giving a sermon that is just beyond the pale. Again, we've imported a problem that should not have been imported into this country. But there it is, and it's there in the streets of Sydney, and it's there in the streets of Melbourne, or at least in the mosques. But in doing so, they forget that actually a Christian pastor or a priest that actually gives a spicy speech about, homosexuality, for instance, they could be done under the same provisions that you're trying to get these radical imams under. And I just think that this is completely and utterly wrong. If it's a direct and intended call for people to go and commit violence, it is already against the law. There was no need to change the law to actually cover that. But what they have done is that they have removed intent. And as I've just said, they've removed the religious protections as well. So, yes, to answer your question, I do believe that a preacher who preaches on Romans in a particular type of way, such as Israel Folau did through a post on Facebook, they might find themselves on the wrong end of this particular law.
Well, he was certainly at risk under previous laws, whether he actually called for violence. Again, there's ambiguity there, which will have to be tested. It's not creating this ambiguity isn't a sort of nice little, doesn't create nice little legal questions for people to debate. It means that people are prosecuted for it, and you have to go through court to try and get some sort of answer in so many cases. Yeah, it's crazy. George, you've alluded to it several times, but what do you ultimately think is driving these free speech restrictions across the board?
It's global. Without a doubt, it is global. We see the same laws popping up in Canada, the UK, the EU, New Zealand now is talking about them. So right the world over, the same agenda is being driven. And then you go and have a look at these supranational organisations such as the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and to a lesser extent, but it's not to a lesser extent, it's just that they're not a supranational organisation, they're a think tank, the World Economic Forum, have been talking about these sort of measures and putting them in place for a long, long time. So there is a globalist agenda to clamp down on free speech, particularly when it comes to online free speech. I'd defy anyone to tell me that there isn't and that that's a conspiracy theory point of view. I mean, it is clear. The UN's recent pact, I've just forgotten the name for it, the global pact that the UN come up with, there are things in that about Pact for the Future. That was it, I think. There are elements in that that are about censoring online free speech. You've had our very own e-safety commissioner go to Davos a number of years ago and tell everyone that she believed that free speech needed to be recalibrated against feeling protected online. I've got to tell you that, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, the most dangerous words that we can hear from any government is, "I'm here to protect you," because quite often, more often than not, that is going to mean they are going to rob you of some freedom in order for you to feel more secure. And there's a famous saying that's been misattributed, but a populace that actually sacrifices liberty for security deserves neither. Mm-hmm. And at this stage, Australia is certainly slinking into that, into that particular area.
There's an agenda, I agree, to avoid scrutiny of decision making globally and certainly international bodies. Hopefully, a lot of that will come out and starting to come out with the, the USID stuff that Elon Musk is helping to unearth. But there's another reason why these laws have being introduced in Australia, I think, which goes back to the Racial Discrimination Act itself, right? And I'm just wondering, is it actually possible to have free speech in a multi-ethnic society?
I believe it is. I can't see why it couldn't be. But the moment that you set one particular ethnic group up as a victim class, then you need protections behind that victim class that actually rob other groups of their rights. So I think it's the way that we approach the multiracial society that we have created in Australia. You know, I don't think it's the fact that we are a multiracial society. Now, look, I could point to the US, which is a bit of a melting pot, and still they have their free speech provisions over there as well. So I don't think it's as easy to say that a multi-ethnic society leads to these laws going away. But I would say that's predicated on one other thing, and that are people who actually come to this country leave the baggage, as in the ethnic violence, the racial and religious violence, and all the rest of the nonsense that they that might have happened in their own home country. They leave it at the door. They don't bring it in. But the problem is that we, as I've said repeatedly, we're seeing play out on the streets of Sydney and Melbourne Middle Eastern problems that should never have actually been imported into this country. And I was a big proponent to say, look, we've got, you know, a whole heap of territory where we know that there is a high level of radicalization, a high level of violent extremism. And it really wouldn't be, I think, racist to actually say we are just going to not take people in from those areas anymore.
It just seems very, you know, ironic to me, George. We clamped down on these laws because of an uptick in anti-Semitic violence, but we're importing, I think, 3,000 Gazan refugees, and we've imported huge numbers of people from the Middle East, where there are long-standing ethnic animosities towards Israel and all sorts of other people. So it's almost like this crackdown on free speech is a distraction because people don't want to take the real action required to at least try to stem the problem, right?
Like, yeah, and you know, it probably also is that it's difficult to unscramble this egg. I mean, we're talking about generations that have been here, and they're actually, you know, no one can contest that a lot of the people that actually unfortunately hold some of these more outlandish views are Australian citizens. So it becomes a very big problem. But what you don't do is keep doing the same thing that gets more and more of the same result. I think that that is the problem, that we now know that, sadly, people that come from certain parts of the world, the Middle East in particular, the reality is that they tribalize, they don't integrate. Studies have repeatedly been shown that 5 years down the track, even 10 years down the track, there is a substantial percentage of these people that come from these places that are still on welfare. So there's a social and economic problem that actually is intertwined here. And I've got to say specifically what I'm talking about, in case someone wants to catch me out here, is refugees. Refugees. There is studies that people can go and look at 5 years down the track, 10 years down the track, there is still a substantial number of those people who arrive in refugee visas that are still on the welfare system. But, you know, the violence and all the rest of it, we don't need it in this country. And I don't know why we would continue with the policies that have actually led to the situation, which, you know, you're right, we're now actually saying we're going to fix a situation by restricting everyone's free speech. Bizarre.
Yeah. So, George, what should concerned citizens do? If you listen to Sky News or other conservative commentators, one of the lines they always say is, you know, everyday people need to speak out and stand up to woke or this, that, and the other. And I'm always like, that's easy for you to say, guys, because you've got the, you know, the protection of a media company behind you. Yeah. And look, I'm a lawyer. I sort of know where the sort of boundaries can lie and where the risks are. And I've been involved in litigation over the years too, which I've won. But what can a concerned citizen do that is unhappy with these laws and other changes that are occurring in society? What can they legitimately do?
Well, this is going to sound so boring and base that some people might roll their eyes, but actually getting off your butt, going to your local Member of Parliament's office and asking for a face-to-face meeting. Now, of course, you're going to get run around the hen house by the gatekeepers there. They'll try and stop it. But if you keep on demanding that sit-down meeting, you might take a number of weeks, might take a number of months. But if you are persistent, you will get it. And sitting down, and you're going to have to do your research, but sitting down and explaining to them, particularly if it's someone that you have voted for, and saying, look, I've cast my vote for you in the past, but here's why I think that this law is bad. You should not have voted for it. And in order for me to actually vote for you at the next election, I'm going to need to know that you're going to do something to actually change this. I mean, look, you might strike out more often than not in terms of an adequate response. But nonetheless, this is every democratic elector's right to go in there and eyeball their Member of Parliament and actually say to them that this is what I want you to do. And if you don't do it, well, it might be bye-bye. At least it's going to be bye-bye for my vote.
Mm. Final question, George. What is Citizen Go, and what should people, how should people reach out to it or get involved in it if that's what they want to do?
Thanks for that. So I'm the national director of Citizen Go in Australia. It's a global organisation, as you've said, not a globalist organisation. An international organisation operates in a myriad of countries where we defend and promote life, family and freedom. So we are unashamedly pro-life. We push back against all of the gender fluidity nonsense, the stuff we see creeping into our education system under the guise of sex education, which these days is more gender fluidity education. And we also push back on restrictions on liberty and privacy for the everyday person. So there's a website set up, citizengo.org. We normally run petitions, and then we take other offline actions. We try to actually be, Dan, as in your face as possible. We're not here to be a lobby group. We're not here to make friends with people in Canberra. We're here to, metaphorically speaking, punch them in the nose. And, well, we want to do that because politicians need to get the message that people are just not going to put up with it anymore. We're not going to keep on just voting the same way because you have this label on and the other guys have that label on. And that's the mission, I guess, of Citizen Go, to try and turn things around so that we have a culture and a society that promotes and defends life, family and liberty.
Sounds good to me. Well, I wish you well metaphorically in your fight as you go on. Thanks again, George Christensen. I really appreciate your time and look forward to catching up in the near future. Cheers, mate. Bye.
Thanks very much, Dan.